Accession number 3997, Reel 3.
Colonel Reddy, Reel 3. Now, while you were at No. 2 Company between January 1935 and December 1936, you were deeply involved in the mechanisation problems of the Sudan Defence Force. How exactly was this?
I was fortunate because No. 2 Camel Company, which was my company, was selected as the first company to be mechanized. But before this could take place, a lot of experimental work was done to develop a suitable tower of low pressure which would enable one to drive a motor vehicle through deep sand. And we were very much involved in this, in cooperation with the transport section in Khartoum and Dunlop's. Various types of tires were delivered to us when we were fitted to Ford trucks and tried out in the desert. One of the first was a very large donut type of tire which was used by the Royal Air Force on their planes. And although this would go through the sand, it was very thin-skinned, and as the sand was full of thorns, it never went very far without puncturing. A great deal of scientific work was done to find out the ratio of the weight of the camel's pad on the sand to the weight of the vehicle wheel and the pressure, in order to arrive at the right pressure in the tires. And after a number of tires had been tried, eventually Dunlop's produced a very low pressure tire which had a sufficiently hard skin to withstand the thorns, and so the first mechanized unit was formed. The vehicles were built on board on Ford chassis in the workshops in Khartoum, and we had I think it was 8 machine gun scout cars, and how many was it? Perhaps a dozen or more trucks for troop carrying and for carrying the baggage and ammunition and the water. And this made a very self-contained unit. But as we'd no experience of a mechanized unit before, we had to devise our own drill and methods of control. And this was basically done by the company commander with a series of different colored flags which he'd fly from his vehicle. He used to lead the column, and each vehicle had similar flags, and they would raise the same colored flag, and so it would be passed down the line so that they all got the message. We had no wireless communication. But we soon were able to develop quite a useful means of control. And it was remarkable how quickly the natives learned to drive. It was a fairly hazardous business teaching them, but once one had got it into their minds as to how to drive, they never forgot, and they were very, very careful.
Did they take an interest in the workings of the cars as
well? No, they took a great pride in their vehicles, very great indeed, yes.
And how many drivers did you have to train over this period?
Well, I suppose we had about 25 drivers in the company, which would allow for one or two spares in case there were some ill. Um, but we relied on a British NCO as the fitter. He had two native fitters with him, but he was the mechanically in charge of the unit.
You must have felt quite excited being a part of the experiment stage.
This was a frightfully interesting work because it was something entirely new, and it was due to this work in 1930s, 36 or so, which enabled in the Second World War the Long Range Desert Groups to operate in North Africa. Because all the work on the right sort of tires to use in the desert had already been done by us.
Was there ever any nostalgia felt for the presumed ending or phasing out of the use of camels?
Oh yes, indeed. It was a sad day when the two camel companies paraded for the last time in their ceremonial dress.
When was that?
It was a magnificent sight. This was on the departure of the commander of the Camel Corps. He was leaving to go to another job, and the companies were paraded for the last time.
How did the Sudanese react, the soldiers themselves?
I think the Sudanese were very well appreciated it, they enjoyed it. This is something new, and they were very keen to belong to it.
So nostalgia was coming perhaps more from the British.
I think so.
You joined the Motor Machine Gun Company after that. What was your experience here?
Well, once we'd developed this unit, we soon found ourselves in demand for patrolling the frontier between the Sudan and Eritrea. At that time, the Italians had decided to invade Abyssinia, and there was a great fear that they were going to do a maneuver into the Sudan and get round into Abyssinia that way. And we were sent down to the frontier at a moment's notice to patrol it. And so one felt almost immediately that we were really on the job.
Well, what were your orders with respect to patrolling? How did the intelligence work in that area?
Well, the intelligence was mainly obtained through the local district commissioner's contacts with certain natives who traded across the border and who knew people who were crossing fairly frequently backwards and forwards, and that was passed on to us. And with these different scout cars, we were able to show ourselves at the frontier, and particularly where there were any Italian posts, and keep them on the qui vive so that they had no idea what sort of force was really against them. I don't think their intelligence was very bright.
And after that you went to Khartoum in 1938.
That's correct, yes.
And your duties here were rather novel, I think.
Well, in Khartoum I was appointed as Deputy Assistant Adjutant General and Assistant Military Secretary at the headquarters. And there I was involved in the commissioning of British officers, the arrangements for new officers coming to the country, and finalising the departure of officers going back to their British Army units. I also was in charge of the establishment of all the Sudan Defence Force, including the British warrant officers and the native officers, and promotions. The responsible for ensuring that when they were due for promotion, they were recommended or not. And also for confidential reports on all officers, which had to be produced, as in the British Army, every year. Of course, as soon as the war came, all movement of British officers from the Sudan Defence Force was frozen. Those that were on leave were brought back, and the program soon involved the expansion of the Sudan Defence Force and the commissioning of many of the civilian district commissioners so that they could legally be employed on military duties. And it was my job to actually carry out the commissioning of all these district commissioners and keep account of where they were and what units they were posted to. There was a subsequent further expansion by way of a local home guard or equivalent of a home guard, which was known as the Sudan Auxiliary Defence Force. And this was further enlistment of specialists, vets and medical officers, and some of the more senior political officers in the more remote parts of the country, which weren't necessarily covered by the Sudan Defence Force, who had for necessity to be concentrated in places where they were most likely to be used, in other words, on the eastern border.
But what was morale like amongst the civilians? Were they all wishing to join, or was there reluctance?
I think the civilians were very much in two minds about it, as to whether this really was a good thing or not. But those that did enlist and got involved in the fighting, I think, really appreciated it very much indeed.
In August 1940, you went to El Obeid. What were your duties here?
Well, at that time, the Camel Corps had been moved to the eastern frontier, and I was sent back to El Obeid to act as commander of the area with the object of supplying the corps with recruits, which meant I had to enlist and train them. I was also responsible for the local defense of the whole of Kordofan, which is an area the same size as France, although most of it is fortunately uninhabited. But it did mean that I was responsible for the security of all the air landing grounds. You can hardly call them aerodromes. They were mostly areas of cleared of scrub and kept where the grass had to be kept cut, and they had to be fit for planes to land. And this was on the direct route from Tekoradi in West Africa to the Middle East. And fighters and bombers used to come through in relays through El Obeid on their way to the Middle East.
And was there thought to be a real threat from the Italians, or was this simply precautionary security?
Well, instructions from headquarters were that all airfields had to be manned 24 hours a day, which meant digging holes in the ground and putting soldiers in them with guns ready to fire on any unauthorized planes which might land. Mercifully, this never happened to me, and nobody had to fire at any plane. But it was a little difficult to, after a year or two, or some months really, to keep the interest of the soldiers sitting in a desert aerodrome with nothing to do.
You had some officers from the Pioneers, I believe, coming at this time.
A little later on, some senior officers from the Pioneer Corps came to enlist Sudanese for pioneer companies. They spoke no Arabic, had absolutely no idea of the customs of the soldiers or the country, and were extremely unpopular and most unwise in their efforts. And eventually they were persuaded to leave. I don't think they got many recruits.
And were you yourself recruiting at this time, or just training recruits sent on to you?
I was recruiting and training.
Mm. How did you go about recruiting?
Much the same way as before. One probably did send soldiers out to the villages to bring them in, where they'd sort of find some of their best pals and who wanted to come and enlist, and whose parents would allow them to go, because they were probably the mainstay of the family and did all the such work there was. But there was never any shortage of volunteers. But
do you think they were very aware of the Italian threat, or was there just a confusion which they dimly perceived to be connected with them?
I think they knew that there was a war on somewhere, but beyond that they didn't really appreciate what was going on, I don't think.
Mm. So you left there with some relief about 9 months later.
Yes, one felt one was in a bit of a backwater there, admittedly, although it was a very important part of the job. I mean, the forces of the front had to be reinforced and kept up to scratch. But one did want to get a little bit nearer the scene of activity oneself.
So you joined the composite battalion?
I was then posted as second in command to the composite battalion, which was a force specially put together to go to the relief of Gondar and Abyssinia.
How exactly was the battalion composed?
As far as I remember, it consisted of, it was four companies based mainly on Eastern Arab Corps companies, because they were the people who lived in that part of the world. And they had a mountain battery attached to them, which by then had been trained in the Sudan. They were pack guns on carried on mules. And the transport for the baggage was on camels and mules, and we marched some 80 or 90 miles into Abyssinia, set up camp, and made contact with the Italians on the escarpment there. There were one or two minor engagements with them, but the rains came and our lines of communication were then closed, and so we had to withdraw to the Sudan until the fine weather came around again. By that time they collected enough motor vehicles so that our supply column was then maintained by vehicles. The road had also been quite a lot of work had been done on it, it made it passable for motor vehicles, because it mostly goes through fairly mountainous country and very rocky roads, and we were very much dependent on our own Sudanese engineer troops in building the road.
And your primary responsibility was for supply, was it?
I was at the base camp.
Which was where?
It was well up the road to Gondar. I can't remember exactly the name of the particular site.
Did you have any problems with supply?
Yes, it was quite a problem, because we had no wireless communication. And so one had to work a week in advance, at least, try to decide how many sacks of flour or boxes of ammunition were going to be required in the following week. And so, because it took 3 days for the convoy to arrive once it had left its base in Gdarif. And it was very tricky to assess exactly what the requirements were going to be.
Did you ever make any mistakes?
Well, we nearly got into trouble one day when the convoy arrived loaded with ammunition, and the commander said that he hadn't got enough rations for the troops, and that they couldn't fight on empty bellies. However, they did scrape up enough just to do that operation, and by that time the next convoy had arrived.
Did you see any fighting yourself?
Not a great deal. Got a bit involved in the Italian shelling when they reached our camp several times, and our own Air Force, who bombed our hospital, which was reported in the BBC as having hit the Italian camp.
How did the Sudanese react to the shelling?
They were pretty frightened, I think, yes. They were pretty frightened, but they were under control. They didn't run away. I don't suppose they were really much worse than any other troops would have been, really.
Did you feel that the medical backup was as efficient as it could have been?
Yes, medical backup was very good indeed, very good. We had a medical officer, and he had his staff of medical orderlies, Sudanese, but they were, Sudan Medical Service is a very good service, and still is today, and they were very well trained.
How did involvement with other colonial forces work?
Oh yes, so finally we got towards the escarpment, having persuaded the Italians to put up the white flag. And although we could reach them on foot, we couldn't drive because they had blasted the road down the mountain. And this had to be repaired. And so our Sudanese engineers started with their pneumatic drills to carve a road out of the rock. At the same time, the King's African Rifles had reached the other side of this break in the road, and they started with their units to mend it from that way, and we met in the middle. And when we met, we were rather astounded to find that only the British NCOs were allowed to use their pneumatic drills, whereas our Sudanese troops were absolutely past masters at it.
How did the Sudanese and the African KAR soldiers react to each other?
Well, they couldn't really speak to each other because they spoke different languages, and so they really kept rather separate. They didn't get together really very much.
Yes. Do you happen to know how involvement at a higher level worked?
There was very close cooperation at the top level, yes. There was no problems there at all.
And how did the Sudanese behave under fire?
Well, I can't honestly say that I actually went into action with them, so I wouldn't really like to answer that one, I don't think.
You returned to Khartoum.
Yes.
I think. And you were in charge of a district. How did this come about?
Well, by that time there were an enormous number of British and Indian Army troops in Khartoum, because the 5th Indian Division had been through and gone up to Keren. And there were a large number of Sudanese troops who were passing through Khartoum on their way back on leave, or we had a force up in the Middle East at that time. But there was no one to coordinate the control of the SDF units in Khartoum, and so they set up a headquarters, which I was put in command to look after all these various different bits of units who were coming and going.
Was this a relatively easy operation, or was there a lot of confusion at the time?
No, I don't think there was a lot of confusion. It just needed somebody to coordinate it.
Yes. And finally, you formed a battalion. How did this come about?
Yes. Well, then they decided the war was really over in the Sudan by then, but they decided on a new establishment for the Sudan Defense Force and decided they needed to increase the size by a battalion. They still had a force up in Egypt, which had to be reinforced from time to time. So it was necessary to form a new battalion. This didn't prove very easy, because at that time there really was a shortage of recruits and a worthwhile type of Sudanese to enlist. So it took several months before one was able to get an adequate number of other NCOs, particularly, who were capable and suitable for this battalion.
Were you personally pleased at being given this appointment?
I was personally pleased purely for sentimental reasons, because my distinguished uncle before me had commanded the 10th Sudanese in the days of the Egyptian army time, and it so happened that I was given the job of forming the 10th Sudan Defense Force battalion.
And you left the Sudan?
Shortly after that, I managed to get permission to rejoin the British Army.
Thank you very much.